Hello, I'm delighted to say that this episode of Film Stories is sponsored by NordVPN. Now, if you're unfamiliar with a VPN, it is a virtual private network, and it's a service that basically allows you to pretend that your computer or device is in a different country. So you set a virtual location for your device, and that means that suddenly you can get access to things that otherwise you might not be able to see. So for instance, if you're a Netflix subscriber, you set your NordVPN to America, then you get a plethora of options from American Netflix rather than UK Netflix, which is where this podcast is based. You can do this with all sorts of things. You switch the virtual location of your VPN service, and then you get access to TV shows, to films, to sporting events, streaming services and such like that you just wouldn't be able to get from the UK. A quick mention too for the cybersecurity features of NordVPN, including shielding your online activities, encrypting your connection, and using threat protection as well. To take advantage of this, you need to go to nordvpn.com/filmstories. That's nordvpn.com/filmstories. And you can try it risk-free with a 30-day money-back guarantee to get the best discount off your NordVPN plan. If you go to that Film Stories link, that will give you an extra 4 months free on top of the 2-year plan. And again, there's no risk with Nord's 30-day money-back guarantee. And you will also find the link in the podcast episode description box. Hello, this is Simon Brew. I'm the editor of Film Stories magazine, and this is the Film Stories podcast. Now, sometimes I struggle to tee these episodes up. This time, though, I've brought in a bit of help from Val Kilmer to explain one of the films I'm going to talk about.
I'm not the first guy who fell in love with a girl he met in a restaurant who then turned out to be the daughter of a kidnapped scientist, only to lose her to a childhood lover who she'd last seen on a deserted island and who turned out 15 years later to be the leader of the French underground.
Yep, done a better job than me. I'm going to start the podcast.
Come with me.
And I show you how deep the rabbit hole goes.
In movies that had stories.
That the story just sucks them in.
This is just the beginning.
Film Stories. We would be honored if you would join us.
Hello and a very warm welcome to Film Stories with Simon Brew. I am Simon Brew. As always, that's absolutely everything you need to know about me. The aim of the podcast, though, well, I'm here to talk of the stories of film. And I talk all sorts. I talk development stories, production stories, marketing stories, release stories, all the little ingredients that go to make the films that we know and sometimes love just that, the films that we know and sometimes love. The films I tend to choose for this podcast, they have more of a mainstream leaning to them than anything else. They're films I'm interested in or invested in to some degree. And in fact, the two films I pulled together for this particular episode, they're ones I'm huge fans of, but I just think not enough people have seen. So let's see if I can do something to convince you, if you've not had the pleasure of either of these, to give them a spin. I'll start with the first of the two movies. I'm going to play you a clip from it. I'll pick up the story the other side of this.
Beautiful country. Man can get lost out here. Forget there's people and things that ain't so simple as this.
I always hoped somebody gentle and caring might come along.
I'm not who you think I am, Sue.
You know, folks around these parts don't take to free grazers.
Always been country plenty for man and beast.
Times change, Mr. Spearman.
You reckon them cows worth getting killed over?
Well, cows is one thing. But one man telling another man where he can go in this country something else.
I got no problem with killing, boss. Never have. Old town knows there's a fight coming. They just hope it don't spill over to them.
The man's got a right to protect his property and his life. And we ain't letting no rancher or his lawman take either.
Men are gonna get killed here today.
That then was a clip from 2003's Western Open Range, directed by Kevin Costner. Screenplay for this one penned by Craig Storper, based on the book by Laurent Payne, The Open Range Men. The cast, led by Robert Duvall, Kevin Costner, Annette Bening, Michael Gambon, and Michael Jetta. And the story of Open Range, well, I mean, it came in the early 2000s onto Kevin Costner's radar. And by this stage in his career, it would be fair to say that his star had faded. He was one of the biggest movie stars on the planet in the early 1990s. It was him or Arnold Schwarzenegger you went to for a big film. But since 1996's Tin Cup, really, he hadn't had much in the way of a hit film. Message in a Bottle had done all right, but 1997's The Postman, which his second directorial effort, had become a target on his back and a notorious Hollywood story of box office failure. 2000's 13 Days, meanwhile, well, that was great. Terrific film. Not enough people went to see it. But then he'd gone and done a couple of bits and bobs. He'd done 3,000 Miles to Graceland with Kurt Russell. That didn't go down very well. And then he did a thriller called Dragonfly, and that didn't do very well either. I'm a huge Kevin Costner fan, but I wouldn't go out of my way for either of those movies, really. And both of them fell at the box office. And so it was against that backdrop that he decided he wanted to direct a Western. Now, he'd done this before. His breakthrough movie, the one that really turned him into a global megastar, was Dances with Wolves, where he'd gambled, he'd taken his rising star, found a story that he really wanted to do, and he shepherded it to the screen himself. I've covered this in a previous episode of the podcast. But at the point he came to the project that would become Open Range, it was nearly a decade since Hollywood had put out what it regarded as a successful Western. He was also, at this stage, admittedly pretty stung by the response he'd had to The Postman. There's an interview in Empire magazine when Open Range came out, where he was questioned about whether the critical backlash had got to him. And he said those people can be happy about that, admitting that they got through his skin on it. He also said at that point, though, that the Western isn't any more formulaic than any of the other genres that exist today, as he talked about why he wanted to make another one. I don't think it's going out on a limb to say Kevin Costner has form with Westerns, Silverado, Wyatt Earp, and of course Dances with Wolves, all on his curriculum vitae. But separately, let's go to writer Craig Storper. Now, he at this stage, a writer and director, a couple of projects under his belt, and he'd optioned a book that Laron Payne had written, and it had been published in 1980, called The Open Range Men. Now, he kind of done this a little bit off-piste. He'd paid for the option himself, and then he'd penned a screenplay as a spec script. And I've got this down to the very end of the 1990s. And a spec script, if you're unfamiliar with the term, is when a writer basically takes the risk themselves. They write a script on spec with the hope that a Hollywood studio will buy it, as opposed to the Hollywood studio buying it and assigning a writer to develop it. So all the risk is on the writer, really, especially when you're paying for an option of the book as well. Now, it was a tough sell. Craig Storper knew this was a tough sell. I mean, the last hit Western, really, had been Clint Eastwood's Unforgiven in 1992, which won Best Picture at the Oscars, but lots had come since then. I've covered The Quick and the Dead in the past, for instance. And there's lots of well-liked Westerns that came out, but none that really caught box office fire again. And others really had failed to get close to what Unforgiven did. It crossed $100 million at the American box office, as did Dances with Wolves a year or two before. Now, by this stage in his life, the author Laron Payne was in his 80s, and Storper was deliberately holding back details on how close the film was happening to try basically not to get his hopes up. Come the end of December 2001, Payne would sadly pass, and it was just after this time that the movie started to come together. And Storper, whilst he wasn't able to give Payne the news, he was able to call Payne's widow and tell her that her late husband's dream had come true. A film of this book that was very dear to him was happening. As it happened, I've not come to this bit of the story yet, but we're getting there, that film would feature Kevin Costner and Robert Duvall. And what had happened to set this up is Costner and Storper had been put together via their respective agents, and they quickly found they were on the same page. They were talking about stories that they liked, they were talking about Westerns, and this project, Open Range, was bubbling up. Costner then was interested. He interested to the point of he was going to direct this one as well. Now, this was nonetheless going to be a very tough film to get going. And he'd been through this with Dances with Wolves, that nobody had wanted to finance that film. But up until he got interest from Hollywood, sort of major at the time, Orion Pictures. But Orion Pictures was out of business at this point. And with his box office star not on the way up this time, as it was when he was trying to get Dances with Wolves together, this one proved to be a struggle to raise the financing. Now, we've just had a Blu-ray release of Open Range here in the UK, which, if you've not seen the film, it's really worth checking out. I do love the movie a lot. But I think it's the German Blu-ray release that I picked up that has all the extras on it. And there's behind-the-scenes material on that where Costner is very, very candid about how difficult this film was to put together, that he was basically making an indie movie here. Now, it got to the point where he brought in some expertise and he called producer David Valdez. Valdez had produced Unforgiven, helpfully. He also called in Jake Ebert. And between the three of them, they put money in to get this film up and running. Nonetheless, by January 2002, this patchwork of funds was in place, but they'd worked out this wasn't going to be backed by a Hollywood studio. It might pick up distribution rights, but it wasn't going to pay for the making of the film. Let someone else take the gamble. That was the theory. So Costner at this stage was in the... I mean, apparently this was around the time Quentin Tarantino sounded him out for a role in Kill Bill, but he turned that project down. This was the one that he wanted to do it. They knew it had to be independent. Now, Costner would have form later down the line of stepping in to fund the original development of a movie again. He put several million dollars into a film called Black or White, which I think came out 2013, 2014 in the end. But with Open Range, what happened is he found a couple of different outlets who would put in some of the funds. So Cobalt Media Group in London was signed up to agree foreign sales, and foreign distribution rights were sold around the world to various different companies, which accounts for why we've only just had a Blu-ray release of the movie in the UK in, what, summer 2021. Disney, actually, through its Touchstone Pictures arm, picked the movie up in North America, but don't be fooled into thinking this was a major movie studio project, that it had picked up distribution. It wasn't paying to make the film. And in fact, Costner, Ebert and Valdez would put in nearly half of the production funds to get this movie made and to the screen. The budget was very low for the standards of what they wanted to do. I think the final budget was calculated around $20 to $22 million. And it was going to take a lot of scrimping and saving. It was going to take a lot of know-how to get it in to that budget level. But nonetheless, they'd found a way, not for the first time, to get a particularly tricky boulder up a particularly steep hill. Now, Costner's catalogue of movies, they, as much as he's done a few Westerns, he's drawn to very American stories, and those American stories sometimes have limited overseas interest. But he knew he wanted to direct this, and he knew in the end that he was the right person to direct it. And he explained this in a big interview he gave with the Washington Post. He said, "I wanted to direct this because I've always believed what's worked most in Westerns are the little things. And if you throw in the obligatory things a little bit on their ear, you challenge yourself to do something original." He got frustrated by the Westerns that have come out in the aftermath of Unforgiven, calling, just describing some of them as effectively costume dramas without naming names. He wanted to do something a bit more authentic and a bit riskier. Going back to that Washington Post piece, he said, "I felt that the little things, given the state of movies, would have been discarded, would have been lost if someone else had directed the movie." He said, "I think that somebody would have gone through it with a fine-tooth comb and eliminated 6 or 7 minutes, which would have been all those little moments. So then you would have had a Western and it would have been pretty good, and it would have been scenic and would have had Robert and Annette," that's Duval and Benning coming to them, "and Michael Gambon, and there would be the fight. But these kind of things that make things memorable and maybe have relevance to your own life, or you're charmed by them or saddened by them or pleased by them, would somehow not make it. And he wanted to protect the material, and he wanted, for this period of his career, he was butting against the convention of what big mainstream movies was. He was resisting sequels to films. He said films such as Bull Durham 2, Tin Cup 2 had been mooted to Robin Hood 2, but he just wasn't interested in doing it. I think it's pretty well known the only sequel he really pursued in the end was The Bodyguard 2, but that project fell apart with the death of Princess Diana. So It came to casting. I mean, Annette Bening was high on the list for the movie, and Costner had always been, I mean, he was asked a couple of times in interviews around this time about casting age-appropriate leads for his films, but he was adamant he wanted the right person for the character. And the character that Annette Bening plays in Open Range, and she's terrific in the movie, I should point out, she plays Sue Barlow, and she's an older woman, and he wanted to cast an older actor to take that role. He said if she was 30 years old, he explained, love is going to pass this woman by, and if she was 30 years old, that wasn't at risk. I think she's beautiful. I like the lines in her face, he explained. Bening was keen to sign on to the movie. Now, in terms of the other major piece of casting with this one, it was clearly Robert Duvall. That Robert Duvall, as was explained in a piece with the AFI, the American Film Institute, he said that with Robert Duvall, he's a very specific actor and a natural actor. I wasn't looking for someone who played boss, the character, as a character, but someone who'd give me a hold-the-screen type boss. And Costner explained it's an important performance, not just a retooling of Lonesome Dove. There's some Duvall background there. There's a key scene in the cafe in the film, which I won't spoil, which I think is an AFI moment for Bob. I stand behind him and just don't say a word. And Duvall was top of Kevin Costner's list for the film. To the point where, I mean, it's one of those cliched stories that goes around that he said he wouldn't have made it if Duvall, he might not have made it if Duvall hadn't taken the role. And you hear this a lot in press junkets and things like that. There might just have been truth to it in this case. I don't think that Costner's particularly known for not straight shooting. Now, in terms of how he approached Duvall to sign him up to the film, because again, this was an indie movie. A call went in to Duvall's agent at the point the screenplay was being rewritten, because when Costner came in, some rewrite work on the script also got underway. Costner's been fairly open about the fact that he's had writing input to lots of the films that he's worked on, whether he's credited or not. And the information was relayed to Duvall's agent that a part was being written specifically for him, and they asked Robert Duvall not to take another role until they'd finished this script and he had a chance to read it. So they got a script to him as fast as they could. Duvall, just at the point it was being sent, would learn that it was a Western. He knew within an hour of reading this that this was a project that he wanted to do. It was all looking like it was coming together. However, there was one slight threat to the production here, where 2 months before filming was set to begin in the summer of 2002, Robert Duvall was involved in a horse riding accident. He was thrown off his horse and he was injured. Now, Duvall at this stage was in his early 70s, and reportedly he suffered 6 broken ribs as when he was thrown off his horse, and this knocked him out completely for 6 weeks. Now, again, this was an independent movie. Had that accident happened 2 weeks later, there is a sporting chance the whole thing would have been off. But it was, I mean, it was still a close run thing. He still had to pass an insurance test before he could do the film, but he just about got clearance to be able to star in the movie. Now, Costner, it was coming to the point where he was directing again, and he would tell Entertainment Weekly he wasn't afraid of this. And in fact, he'd come close to directing 13 Days previously before giving over control of that one to Roger Donaldson. But again, there was no getting away from the fact that 1997's The Postman, which I will come to in a future podcast, had given him something of a kicking. As he said to Entertainment Weekly, these are his words, not mine, "I guess it's kind of like sex. I don't watch anybody else make love. So I'm not sure if I'm doing it the right way. I direct my own way, which seems to be 24 hours a day, so it takes a lot out of me." This is reportedly why he didn't direct quite as often, but this was also why he was getting back on the metaphorical saddle. So, on the 17th of June 2002, off the production had gone to Canada, to the Alberta area in Canada, where it was going to shoot on location out in the open. But of course, preparatory work had been going on there for some time, because the original plan had been to shoot this in America, in the San Fernando Valley area, the home of many classic Westerns. But there was development work ongoing there that had made that not an option for this particular production. And it was producer David Valdez who suggested, why don't you go and have a look at Alberta? That was where Clint Eastwood had shot Unforgiven, and that had looked pretty good. And Costner agreed. And so off they went. They did some location scouting. They found lots of little towns that they could potentially use to shoot this one. But he wasn't happy with what he saw. And instead, they decided to spend a good chunk of the production budget on basically building a town from scratch. It would cost $1 million to build the town. And Costner was insisting on finding landscapes where you couldn't see roads, you couldn't see fences, you couldn't see other people. This had to be a town in the middle of nowhere. But that demand in itself also added another $40,000 to the price, because they built this in such a remote part that they had to build the road to get the crew there. It's explained this on the Blu-ray extra feature, that you see they had to build the access point, otherwise all the equipment couldn't come in. Now, going as spoiler light as I possibly can, there's a moment where quite a lot of water also hits this town. And so also as part and parcel of the building costs of the set for this one, they had to put in a huge tank. A huge tank as part and parcel of the construction, which would hold 32,000 gallons, well, be able to pump 32,000 gallons of water down the street when required every single minute. And so basically it was an underground network of pipes that was required to keep that water being recycled and to make it a working set for what they needed it to be. Now, Costner's directorial style, he talked to an interview popped up at Screen Rant of all places, where he talked quite interestingly about this. And he talked about when he's directing, he calls the shots and he has a tendency to shortchange himself. And I've seen this from lots of actor directors, that they shoot lots of coverage and they try and help all the other actors, and then they don't do enough of themselves. Then Costner explained, "I don't shortchange other actors, but I have a tendency when I'm directing myself to go, okay, I got it." And he admitted on Open Range, "Once in a while, somebody close to me goes, 'Why don't you do another take? Why are you rushing yourself? Because you're always rushing to help the other actors.' And then you go, 'I've got it.'" And they were telling him, take some more time with his performance. Just take a little bit of time. And he found that good advice. And I go back to the difference of directorial styles on A Perfect World, the film that Costner made with Clint Eastwood, where Eastwood was reportedly happy with one or two takes and Costner always wanted a couple more. And Costner, I think it'd be fair to say, was more aware of what his actors wanted than probably Eastwood was on that particular movie. Costner was also trying to pace the film a little differently. He knew in his head that he wanted to not make this conventional Hollywood, that he wanted to start this one slow and build it up and not kick things off with a massive action moment or something like that. And he was conscious of that as he was putting it together. But nonetheless, going back to that German Blu-ray release, you see how much he's pushing against it. There's quite a lot of grumbling as to how little money they have and how difficult it is to try and realise what they're doing under the umbrella of an independent movie. But then conversely, there are also things that clearly weren't going to be compromised. There is an absolutely superb gunfight in Open Range, which is shot very wide. I mean, that's unconventional in itself, but also it was choreographed well in advance, deliberately chosen, and as much rough and ready as it might appear on screen, which is kind of the point of it, the work was going in preparation. One person who Costner was particularly happy to give latitude to as well was Robert Duvall, who was improvising a little as he went along. Annette Bening as well is someone he just said he found a joy directing. And I guess the other challenge, though, that it was coming up against was this was a film being shot outdoors in the summer in Canada. And as such, I mean, it's a film as well that's got quite a lot of night scenes in it, but there wasn't actually a lot of night. It was high summer. The skies got dark quite late and they got light again very early. And they had a few hours, really, when they were trying to do the night shoots to get that material in the can. But nonetheless, it's the old adage, you're away from Hollywood, you're an independent movie. He had the space to make the film that he wanted, and it all wrapped up on the 8th of September 2002, which gave Costner time to take it into the edit and to take his time with the edit as well. It wasn't set for release until the summer of 2003, and he brought in Michael Kamen to do the score of this one. I mean, he'd worked on the shoot too with J. Michael Moreau, a cinematographer, who was really, this was a big break for him, having worked with Costner before on Dance to the Walls. But it was Costner and editor Miklos Rai in the editing room putting this together. And then there came the matter of, well, how do you promote it? How do you push it? Because in America, at least, this was going out through Disney's Touchstone Pictures label. And Touchstone, Disney wanted top billing to go to Kevin Costner. Kevin Costner wanted top billing for this. Well, he wanted it to go to Robert Duvall, and Touchstone, to its credit, ceded to its star on this one, and Robert Duvall is rightly top billed on the movie. Nonetheless, it was Costner a lot front and centre inevitably during the promotion of it. I mean, he produced it, he directed it, he was co-starring in it. And he's quite sanguine during some of that promotion as well. I mean, he talked to the Washington Post and he would look at Open Range. He said, this is not what you'd call a career move. He said the career move would be making Tin Cup 2. That's what you'd do. You'd resurrect Bull Durham. I mean, he did an interview with the BBC and this goes to what he was kind of pushing against at the time. And he was asked, do you worry now how critics, audiences will react to a Kevin Costner film because of all the publicity surrounding your last couple of directing projects? And he just said, I'm not afraid. He said, I don't walk through life like a daisy. I still believe in the movie experience, and I believe people are looking for movies like this, not just because it's a Western, but they're looking for fresh air, for a good story, for something they can share with others. And he argued this is one to see opening weekend, and it's one to pull off the shelf 5 years from now too. Now, the brilliant Michael Jetta, this is his last movie role as well. And Costner would confirm during the promotion of this that he would get to see the movie. He got to see the movie before he died. He died before the film was released. There was a little bit of, well, Rai smiling really at the Motion Picture Association of America, that the MPAA, the American Ratings Board, gave this an R rating. And generally the creatives felt that it should have been a PG-13. They weren't particularly happy, but conversely, they didn't seem to fight it too hard. And then as the film came towards its release, which in the US was August the 15th, 2003, we wouldn't get it in the UK till March 2004, a long way behind, he was still doing those interviews and he was still being asked, what do you think the box office chances are here? Will this put your career on track? And he did say, my career is on track. And he said, does my movie need to be The Hulk or need to be Bad Boys? I mean, that'd be interesting. I feel like my movie has as much value as those movies. If someone wants to measure things in dollars, then that's how they will see the world. It's just not how I see it. Interestingly, though, Open Range then proved, against expectation, to be a box office surprise, certainly in the US, that it opened August the 15th to the 17th in America. It opened off the back of really good reviews as well. I mean, it got a very, very warm response, this one. And if we go to that opening weekend and you see what it was up against, well, Freddy versus Jason was the big movie that opened that week. Uptown Girls was a new opener as well. The big holdover was SWAT. Open Range and Animation was out. So even though it was summer, it was late summer, August of 2003, a point where August was still just coming to the last vestiges of that being sort of a dumping ground for less high profile movies. Open Range was in a competitive field. Freddy vs. Jason grossed 36.4 million. It was always going to do that level of number, I think. But Open Range opened in third place with $14 million. And this took people by surprise. What continued to take people by surprise was it was still in third place the week after. It had added another $9.5 million to its take. Still in the top five the week after that, another $8 million. Whilst it would ultimately peter out as more and more films came to compete with it, it proved to be what was regarded as a modest success at the box office. It grossed $58 million at the American box office. Now, the whole idea that Westerns don't travel overseas and American stories sometimes struggle to travel overseas, well, that held true to a degree. I mean, it only grossed, what, $10 million overseas? A modest hit in France, a modest hit in the UK. Did some good business in Italy as well. But this was a film that petered out, what, $68 million worldwide. But conversely, it had been an indie movie that they'd really gambled to bring the funds together for, $22 million to make, and has proven to be something of a success. It's been hard to find on assorted home formats over the years, just because the rights were so scattered for so long. But it is now finally out there, and it does pop up on streaming services as well. I think Open Range is a really underrated gem, and it's a not often seen gem as well. And I think the key three performances, Duval, Annette Bening, Kevin Costner, are just terrific in this one. Michael Gambon clearly having a ball as well. And it's easy to say they don't make them like this anymore, but the Western appears to have completely gone out of vogue again, perhaps until Kevin Costner decides, on the big screen at least, appreciating he's doing Yellowstone on the small screen, he wants to make another one. Which brings me to the halfway point of this latest episode of Film Stories. Just a little bit of business to tell you about. I've got another live show coming up in Birmingham here in the UK on the 29th of September 2021. It is at the Midlands Arts Centre. You can find more information on my website, filmstories.co.uk, or you can go to the Midlands Arts Centre directly. I am intending to give a back issue of the magazine to everyone who comes along. We're just trying to work out how to do that at the minute as well. I do have magazines. If I mention magazines, Film Stories magazines and the Film Stories Blu-ray of Sneakers, all available at store.filmstories.co.uk. But I go on about this a lot, but it's entirely true. I am 100% an independent. I'm not a big business or anything like that. I am a nerd in a room in the West Midlands. And even though Tom Cruise has been here this week, as I record, filming Mission Impossible 7, it's not the most glamorous part of the world. And sometimes the only reason that the whole Film Stories project keeps going is thanks to your support. There are various ways to support this podcast. I'm grateful for any of them. You can go to Patreon, patreon.com/SimonBrew. And support us there. All funds there are invested into the Film Stories project. And there are, at the time of recording, a couple of podcast specials that aren't widely available anywhere else yet. If you can ideally subscribe to this podcast, that helps me enormously. And likewise, if you can leave ideally a hugely positive review, I'd be very, very appreciative. Now, though, I'm going to crack on with the second of the two films I'm going to talk about in this episode. I love this film, too. It is one of my favourite go-to comedies. Let's go back to 1984. I'll play you a clip.
We must proceed nonetheless. There is too much at stake.
Here, kind sir, smell this flower. It never fails to amuse the parties.
It's very good.
The Germans are planning something. Time is running out.
Have you found out where Dr. Flamand is being kept?
Here. This is one of our most popular items.
It's very good. It's very good, yeah.
We do not know where they are keeping Dr. Flamand, only that they are forcing him to build a new weapon.
What are my instructions?
Here. Try this. This will make you very popular at social gatherings.
Go tonight to the valley. Here, use this ticket. You will meet the leader of the resistance, a man known as the Torch. Until then, wait at the Howard Johnson's. It's on the corner of the Führerstrasse and Goebbels Platzen. Good luck, kind sir, and God be with you.
Wait. You dropped your phony dog poo.
What phony dog?
Souvenirs, novelties, party tricks, souvenirs.
That then is a clip from 1984's comedy Top Secret, directed by Jim Abrams, David Zucker and Jerry Zucker, written by Abrams, Zucker and Martin Burke, with a cast led by Val Kilmer in his first big film role, Lucy Gutteridge, you've got Christopher Villiers, Jeremy Kemp, Omar Sharif, you heard there, Peter Cushing, Michael Goff. You also get, for Downton Abbey fans, Jim Carter in one of his very, very early roles as Deja Vu. It's a film, this one, that still flies under lots of people's radar, but there's sort of reasons for this. So the bubble had, at the point the Top Secret story starts, really, the bubble hadn't quite burst for Zucker, Abraham Zucker, the comedy team that had memorably come together. First of all, for the sketch movie, Kentucky Fried Movie, that had been built out of their theatre shows. But then in particular for 1980's Airplane, a flat out modern comedy classic that they basically ripped up the rule book a little bit, and the amount that that film is still watched today, over 40 years later, pretty much tells the story of its legacy. Now, they followed that up, although it wasn't the original intention, I'll come to this in a second, with a small screen project by the name of Police Squad. That was a 6-series TV show. They'd looked at doing it as a film, but figured it worked better as a show, that pretty much sank like a stone, but it would birth the character of Lieutenant Frank Drebin. Police Squad is brilliant as well. It was one of those where it shouldn't have sunk like a stone, and it did. And many years later, the Naked Gun trilogy would begin spun out of the Police Squad series. Now, the trio would also notably pass on making Airplane 2, the sequel. That went to another director. They didn't see the point of doing that. But, so what they got is they went Airplane, and they worked together on Airplane, they worked together on Naked Gun, but there's the spoof movie they did in between that's the one that goes off radar, and that is Top Secret. And Top Secret was originally the film that they were going to move on to straight after Airplane. But the problem was they couldn't work out to crack what they were trying to do. They had a couple of different things they wanted to do. They wanted to do a parody of the kind of films that Elvis Presley was making. They wanted to do a spoof of old World War II movies. They wanted to make it contemporary as well. And they had some difficult ingredients to juggle there. And as David Zucker would say, we had ideas for scenes we wanted to do. We tried to fit the plot around the scenes, and they just couldn't quite crack it. It wasn't working. They couldn't find the structure for the film. Now, if you go back to Airplane, they found the structure by buying the rights to another film and copying that one. Airplane, as is pretty well known, is a remake of an older film called Zero Hour that in the end they were leaning so close on it, they just bought the rights so that they'd be able to call it a remake if needed. But the structure was in place. Here, they were trying to juggle some very, 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 very diverse ideas. That the war movie alone could be a parody. The Elvis movie was a parody. And so which were they going to do? And as Zucker admits, in the end, we couldn't decide, so what we did was to combine them. Now, the combining them led to the core team, Jerry Zucker, David Zucker, Jim Abrahams, locking themselves away in a room, and they worked for a while in the offices of their lawyer. Their lawyer had some spare space, and they would sit around and get in at 9:30 every morning, take a while to get up and running, but they would start writing and writing and writing. And because there were three of them in the room that had been working together for about a decade by this point, they would build on each other's jokes. And they had plenty of them. There was no shortage of gags. But what finally helped them fashion this into a working script was the hiring of a fourth person, a man called Martin Burke. Now, to this point, it's worth noting, the three of them had worked pretty much exclusively together. They hadn't brought another character, another collaborator in at any point. So this was a big deal that they brought in Burke. I mean, he'd worked on the film, he directed the film The Last Chase in 1981. He'd direct a notorious Sylvester Stallone box office flop called Avenging Angelo. That would be in 2002. But Zucker, Abraham Zucker, credited Martin Burke with sorting this film out. That suddenly they didn't just have the jokes, they had a structure to put them into. They had some kind of framework into which they could wrestle their ideas. With Police Squad not the success that they'd hoped, Top Secret then came back onto their radar, and Paramount Pictures was interested in backing them again. I mean, they'd not made a film since Airplane. Airplane had been a huge hit. So, of course, Paramount, which banked, what, 160, 170 million off a 3 million budget for Airplane or something like that, of course it was going to give them another go. And so they started getting to the point where they put the movie together, and they'd approach this slightly differently. If you go back to Airplane, they filled that movie with cameos of well-known faces playing a little bit against type, but they thought, we've already done that. And so they resisted that idea this time, although Omar Sharif is a notable example for that. And instead, they were looking for relatively unknown performers to take on the lead roles, in particular, the key lead role of Nick Rivers. Now, Nick Rivers is, as Jim Abrams argued, is the role that Elvis Presley never got but should have played. And they saw quite a few people for the part, one of whom was Val Kilmer. Now, Val Kilmer at this stage was doing well in theatre. He'd been classically trained as an actor, and he was in a play in New York called Slab Boys, but he was already familiar with the work of Zucker Abrahams Zucker, that he'd seen Kentucky Fried Chicken a few times, and he wanted to work with them. He took the meeting, and he really prepared for his audition as well. Now, at the point this podcast has been recorded, a documentary film called Val, featuring lots of Val Kilmer's home footage, has been released, and in that you see an awful lot of the preparation that he puts into his auditions. This was no different, that he would be prepared Elvis songs to sing, he got costume together, and when he came in for the audition, he won over the filmmakers quickly. Another classically trained actor would take on the role of Hillary, the second lead in the movie, Lucy Guttridge. She had a background with the Royal Shakespeare Company, and they broke that cameo role for Omar Sharif. Best known for Dr. Zhivago, and then here he is. And he absolutely went for it when it came to the shoot as well. He was hired, he got a good check for just a few days' work, but thoroughly enjoyed doing so. Perhaps the other best known name in the movie was Peter Cushing, and he got into the spirit of it as well. This was, though, a more expensive production and a more on-radar production than the trio had had with Airplane. That the budget for the film, I mean, still wasn't a huge amount in the scheme of Hollywood even at the time. It's going to cost $8.5 million to make. It would be the most expensive thing they'd done to this point. I mean, nearly three times the cost of Airplane, that. But the success of Airplane had bought them a bigger train set to play with. The flip side of that was there was no way these three were going to fly under the radar again. When Top Secret came around, people would know about it. This wouldn't be a surprise. So, with all that in mind, they decamped to the UK, ready for the shoot in the summer of 1983. They'd used loads of locations around the UK. They got quite close to where I'm sitting, here in the West Midlands in England. They were based, I think it's primarily out of Pinewood. It may have been Shepperton. I can't nail down exactly which of the two it was. But the point was, they were shooting this a long, long way from Hollywood, that they were, and they had the space, really, to explore and to find their movies. And the three of them would be directing again. Now, Val Kilmer, again, let's go back to that documentary. He touches on Top Secret in his feature movie, in the documentary. But it's almost a little bit dismissively, I thought. It just notes that it's lightweight, and certainly compared to something like The Doors that we see him in that film preparing for later on in the documentary, it's hard to argue. But also, he wasn't always too happy during the making of the film. Now, the directors have been just as candid about this. There's a big looking back at the movie over at the Screen Crush website that I do recommend checking out. And David Zucker would describe to that outlet about how some days they'd get one Val Kilmer and on another day they get another Val Kilmer. And this is where Kilmer's classically trained background wasn't helping massively either, because it led to him taking the film way too seriously. Now, I'd argue that helped with the performance, that he plays it completely straight, but also, I mean, Jim Abrams, I think it was, who would admit that the character of Nick Rivers isn't actually brilliantly written. It's quite hard to wrestle with, and Kilmer struggled to wrestle with him. They told him to try and have more fun with the role, but it wasn't really happening. That's not where Kilmer's headspace was. But Kilmer also would counter this a little bit to the Los Angeles Times in an interview around the time. And he said, he talked of working with three directors. And he said, among the three of them, a lot of energy gets used up in the compromise process that could otherwise be used with an actor or cameraman. And he noted one particular example in that interview where there's a big sight joke about where a giant pigeon, it does its business, no way around that, in a scene that takes place in a park. And at that point, they were arguing, should a giant pigeon have a poo in the film? And what swung the decision in the end was that the movie had gone a couple of minutes without a joke, and so they decided to give it a try. But Kilmer cited that as just one example of when they would just be arguing about stuff rather than making the film. Now, the counter to that is fairly obvious, and they've talked about it before. It's just like, yeah, they debated stuff. That was part and parcel of making the movie. Now, because of the failure of Police Squad, there were questions about whether there was a fear of failure with making the film. And it counters a little bit with what Kilmer was saying there. And Jerry Zucker addressed this. He said, if it was just one of us making it, we probably would feel very much that way, a fear of failure. But he says, because since there are three of us, there's a feeling of always being saved from your own mistakes. He said, when two of us agree, we're usually right, or at least it ups the chances. And he says, we end up working out a lot of compromises that better than either of the two sides, because we're forced to argue with each other and to defend our positions. We're always rethinking them, and that leads to better ideas. Now, that doesn't negate the fact that they would describe that some days they get one Val Kilmer and some days they get another Val Kilmer, but it just goes to light the cauldron of making this movie. And it also, it'd be remiss to say, there weren't some really ambitious sequences here. So there's a sequence where, I mean, Peter Cushing was hired to play a German bookkeeper in the movie, with a scene that, I mean, going as spoiler light as possible, involves him putting books on shelves. And that was, it's a really complex scene when you look at it, that they had to shoot in reverse, and it took 2 days of the production cycle to do, because they spent one day rehearsing that whole sequence to get it right. It helped that there's a stunt dog in the midst of it all who wasn't playing ball, and then the following day they had to shoot it, and it took 17 takes. They went a bit David Fincher there to get that in the can, again having to wrestle a dog, metaphorically I should point out, to get it right. But also, one of the absolute standout sequences is a bar fight scene that takes place underwater. And it's a proper fight scene as well, but it just happens to take place underwater. And they filmed this in the tank, in the huge tank at Pinewood Studios, and they didn't use any visual tricks to do it. They shot people underwater having a fight, that they had to do it in 15, 20 second clumps so that people could hold their breath. There'd be divers at the edge of the tank going in to give the actors the oxygen. But basically, they were having a choreographed fight underwater with props. They shot it as is and then just knitted that together in the edit. Top Secret, I should point out, is a very musical film, and it spoofs very much a style of music, and Val Kilmer was game for that. He performs all the songs in the movie himself, and in fact he would turn up credited on the soundtrack album for doing so as well. And there's one little nugget I found. I mean, this is on the disc extras. There's a glorious commentary track on the Blu-ray, that there's a moment where they look down, and it's from a great height to the street below, and it's using some miniature effects to do so. In fact, what they're using is a discarded miniature effect from Superman that they found in the waste bin of the studio, and they decided to try and find a way to weave that into the film, which they duly did. So the film shot in that summer of 1983. I think it was pretty much done and dusted by the end of September. And they brought it in a little bit under budget as well. But they put together a first cut of the film that played for 2 hours, and is often the case with comedies. They'd done this with Airplane, films such as like American Pie were doing it 15 years later. They took it round college campuses in the US to test the film, to see if the jokes were working. And their focus on the testing was, are people laughing at the gags? That was the killer for them. They wanted the comedy to land. And it will go to a criticism of the film I'll address shortly. But as they took it round more and more university campuses, they gradually brought the film down and brought the film down and brought the film down to its what, 90 minute running length, which was the state in which it was released. There was still a little bit of to and fro going on behind the scenes, that they put quite a lot of jokes in the end credits of the movie. They'd really gone for this, actually. I mean, there's one where they list the focus puller, then the clapper loader, then the focus loader, then the clapper puller, then the puller clapper, then the clapper clapper, then the flipper flapper, then the haberdasher. And that's just a small taste of the ones that are in there. These end credits were queried in a memo that Paramount Pictures sent to the filmmakers, but again, they stood their ground on this one. And there was a feeling that this might hit, this could work. However, there was also something that they never managed to marry up, which was the fact that, and they've been candid about this since, they're candid in the disc commentary as well, that the story of Top Secret doesn't work. Jerry Zucker would in fact concede to Screen Rush that if Airplane is a movie, he said, Top Secret is a joke book. They talk about how the film features spoofs of films its audience just hasn't seen, even though they've always been fairly upfront about the fact that the jokes have to work standalone. You can't parody a movie and work on the assumption that a member of the audience has seen the film that you're talking about. That notwithstanding, there was potentially a problem on the horizon here, in that as a piece of narrative, it just didn't hold together anywhere near as well as Airplane did. In fact, when the reviews came in for this one, I mean, it was pretty mixed. Pretty mixed. I mean, it was credited for just the sheer amount of jokes that hit. And I think that is clearly the huge, huge positive of it. I absolutely love this film. And it's that one, in terms of joke hit rate, I just think this is off the chart. But as people rightly noted, there's barely an ending to it. The last act of it, it just kind of holds together a little bit. And if you dig beneath the jokes, you don't necessarily find an awful lot of stuff there. But that doesn't matter. We've seen enough comedies released over the years that are barely funny, for instance, and still go on to box office success. As long as Top Secret wasn't up against anything particularly difficult, it should surely make its money back. What, $8.5 million to make? So, opens June 22nd, 1984 in the US. Resident at the top of the charts 3 weeks on in the week of its release. Just look at this for competition. The top three were Ghostbusters, Gremlins and Indiana Jones and the Temple of Doom. There were four new releases that week. Top Secret was one. Rhinestone with Sylvester Stallone and Dolly Parton. That was another. The Karate Kid, that came out exactly the same week. And then you had The Pope of Greenwich Village as well. And Top Secret opened in seventh place with $4.4 million at the US box office, trounced by quite a lot of the competition there. But still, this was an era where you could build your audience over a number of weeks and that would be fine. Problem was, Bachelor Party came out the week after and played pretty much the same crowd and knocked it down the chart. And within 3 weeks, Top Secret was clinging on in the top 10, whilst Ghostbusters and Gremlins just stayed resident at the top. They were still topping the chart nearly a month later. I think it was Purple Rain, which landed at the end of July, was the first one to de-seat Ghostbusters or Gremlins from the top of the US box office. In all, the movie would make, about $20 million. I mean, it wasn't a massive flop. It was a disappointment, but Paramount Pictures got its money back and it would prove to be a cult video hit over time. And it's worth noting that Top Secret would eventually find its audience, but it would be a cult audience. That there are screenings that I've put on a couple myself. There are screenings that crop up every now and then, however many years on we are now, it's a horrible amount to consider because then I'd be old. And the argument is the movie holds up. There's one joke at the start that they all the creators criticise, where Val Kilmer makes a joke about the age of someone's daughter. They just said, we would just cut that straight out. Straight away, it makes the character unlikable and just isn't a pleasant joke to make. But other than that, they pretty much stand by the film as it is. However, their directing partnership was coming to an end. They would do one last movie together, which would be a hit, but it wouldn't be a spoof. They decided to take a slightly different path. That would be the film Ruthless People. But then, over time, they went their separate ways as directors. Jim Abrams went first with films like, Big Business was a hit, but he would find his bigger hit with Hot Shots in the early 90s. Jerry Zucker went on to make a film called Ghost. David Zucker would solely direct The Naked Gun, although Jerry Zucker and Jim Abrams would still remain involved in it. And they each, after Top Secret and after Ruthless People, would go on to have a big Hollywood hit each to their name. However, Top Secret has become the hidden gem that's endured. And one of the reasons I wanted to do it on this podcast was I hope occasionally I talk about a film that you've not seen that you're just inclined, I might just go and give that a chance. Both of the films in this episode, I would suggest firmly go into that bracket. That in very different ways, they're both very special films. Top Secret remains for me a comedy masterpiece, even though I accept everything about how the plot falls apart and you don't look at it too closely. But heck, did I laugh. Which brings me to the end of this latest episode of Film Stories. Thank you so much for your time. If you're not bored completely of my waffling, you'll find me on Twitter at Simon Brew. I've got a whole lot more there. You can find the entire Film Stories project on Twitter at Film Stories Pod. There's a website, filmstories.co.uk. That's the website. Every weekday, that's updated with movie news, with reviews, with features, with all sorts of movie nerdisms, really. Recently, I've been breaking down the email screen of Casino Royale and what it tells us about James Bond's email inbox. So, yeah, if you're looking for that particularly compelling piece of work, you'll find that there. You can buy our magazines. You can buy our Blu-ray off Sneakers, which we're still shipping out at store.filmstories.co.uk. We're on Facebook at facebook.com/filmstoriesonline. You can find us also on YouTube at youtube.com/filmstories. With all that collection of plugs out the way, this is the bit where I leave you in peace. I thank you for your time. And the most important thing, as always, is that you're all safe and well and that you look after yourselves. I'll be back soon with another bunch of film stories. Take care, everyone. Bye-bye.
This is not Del Torme.